This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here at IBM Interconnect in Las Vegas, and I'm talking to Ramesh Gopinath.
Hi, I'm Ramesh Gopinath. I'm responsible for the blockchain solutions that we develop in IBM.
Could you give us a bit more depth around the blockchain solutions? We get a lot of press announcements about blockchain. We see a lot of stage presentations, but I'm not sure any of us really have a handle on the breadth and depth of the products you've already brought to market.
It's been an amazing 1 year plus, I would say, in this space. I still remember the very first project that we did in trade finance. This was in the beginning of 2016. And we're now, you know, at about 400 odd client engagements today. The other interesting thing is, you know, in the first half of last year, you know, most of these engagements are POCs. Let's go experiment, let's try out something. Somewhere in the June, July timeframe, there was a dramatic transition, at least in one pocket in financial services, where people were looking at actual production deployments. So the conversation shifted from what I would call blockchain tourism. By that I mean, you know, you do a POC with no clue as to what you would do beyond the POC. Now we are much more, you know, careful in terms of qualifying engagements to ensure that these are not tourism examples, but much more of something that could become bigger, assuming technically it works, et cetera, et cetera. Just to give you some of the examples of the things we're doing, I would cluster it into sort of three buckets. I think the biggest bucket is in terms of percentage of client engagements we have is in financial services. There, I'll walk you through an example of what we are doing ourselves in IBM Global Financing, the work that we are doing with banks. I'll give you a couple of examples right off the bat. For example, the work that we're doing with CLS Bank, which does continuous linked settlements. This is the bank that does, you know, almost $5 trillion worth of Forex transactions every day. We are working with them on their CLS Net solution, which and it was announced in September last year at Sibos, and hopefully they'll go into production late this year or early next year, right? I know we don't hold the timeline, but at least that's an example of actual production systems. Another one is the work that we are doing with DTCC. This was announced in January this year. They were trying to replatform the entire credit derivatives platform, and moving over to blockchain has the advantage of managing the entire lifecycle, these derivatives, credit derivatives, across all the bank participants in a trusted fashion. So that's the other example I can think of. Then we did something with Northern Trust very recently. You've heard about that. So those are some examples. I'll come to the IGF later because I'll give you in more detail what we've done there. Then the second big bucket we were discussing earlier, it's grown very, very fast. In fact, the first conversation I had with Maersk sometime in 2015 in December was to say, hey, look, here's this cool new idea. Maybe it's going to revolutionize global trade. Question was, what is blockchain? Similar thing happened in sort of March, April of 2016, when I flew into Bentonville and met a bunch of people at Walmart. And again, the first question was, what are you talking about? What is this thing again? From there to where we are today, for example, the work with Walmart on food safety. In fact, I would call it food transparency more than safety, because it's a wonderful thing if you think about it. If I can walk into a store, buy sliced mangoes, and I know the entire provenance of where it came from, whether the processors who touched the mangoes, worked with it, had the right, you know, health certificates, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing with pork in China is another thing that we're doing with Walmart. So that's just to give you a concrete example of something where things have moved dramatically since, you know, from a very early beginning. Another one is the work that we're doing with Maersk. That's really what we call global trade digitization. Essentially, the focus there is to address some key supply chain pain points, especially when it comes to ocean trade on containers. Things haven't changed much since the days of Marco Polo in some sense, except the container itself was a 1956 invention by a brilliant person. In fact, container shipping has done more for globalization than anything else, as far as I can tell. So there, the pain points we're going after are twofold. First is, if participants along the supply chain knew where a container is or what state the goods in the container is, for example, if it's vaccines, is it within a temperature range? That sort of information is dramatically valuable for everybody, all the way from the retailer at the one end who might be, you know, looking to receive the vaccines or the avocados or what have you. You basically can plan operations, better inventory management. By the way, just inventory management, retailers, essentially the cost of that. Now, overstocking, understocking costs can be of the order of $1 trillion. I'm not saying ocean trade touches that trillion as a whole, but the point is, it's a big number that you're dealing with. Ports, if they had visibility into when the ship is coming, what containers are in there, what you need to do with those containers in advance, they could plan the operations of people, because people eventually are involved. The assets that they have, cranes and other things, can be optimally used. Enough said. My main point is, along the entire supply chain, everybody sort of benefits from that visibility. Another capability that we are looking at in the same context is what I would call document work, inefficiency related to manual paper-based processes. The Marco Polo reference was just to make the point that how does things happen when you ship? You have lots of papers that the shipper has to generate. There could be bill of lading, a packing slip, certificate of origin. You give it to maybe a freight forwarder or somebody who handles it. It goes through various hands, gets stamped by customs, for example, approval, etc. That entire process, if you could digitize, things could change dramatically. In fact, we did some analysis, and also the World Shipping Council has given some numbers to give you a sense of inefficiencies related to this paper-based processing can be of the order of $38-40 billion plus minus. Own experience, while doing this project with Maersk, we looked at a specific example of shipping avocados and flowers from Mombasa to Rotterdam. Typically, the cost of the paperwork that goes with the flow, the paperwork that goes along parallel to the flow of the goods itself, that cost can be 20%. Just put it in perspective, if it's $2,000 that a shipper pays Maersk to move the container, they're paying somebody else $300 to $400 to just manage the paperwork. If you could do it digitally, it'll be great. Now, all of these use cases you see, what do you see? There is a lot of handoffs between participants in a supply chain. Financial services, similar. The biggest problem prior to blockchain was the fact that there wasn't enough trust in the system for people to share all this information. Now you have an opportunity to share information across participants in a selectively visible fashion, so you can do it in a privacy-preserving, confidentiality-preserving manner, and everybody can benefit. So that's the promise of blockchain, and so that's what we're seeing in supply chain.
How do you drive down the point of entry where you can take it right the way down to source? If we take food safety, we look at it, and from the abattoir forwards for meat, that should be relatively easy to track. The challenge is tracking what's coming into the abattoir from people downstream who maybe are not large organizations. They may be small suppliers. They may not have a lot of technology availability. They're living on a breadline as it is, expecting them to pay for a technology solution on top. So to get that true end-to-end becomes a challenge there. Similarly, in the examples you were giving around customs, we've always known the amount of flexibility, shall we say, within paperwork chains. And that's where much of the fraud and the theft is facilitated. How do you persuade all of those customs agents, particularly in small countries or in third world countries, whether governments like it or not, graft is a way of life for getting things into the shipping mechanism? How do you make it so that these people are engaged? You bring the price, the entry point down, the simplicity of the whole solution down.
I'll address both separately, but at top level, I think the way we are thinking about it is in the foods transparency example, as well as in the global trade digitization examples, this is going to be a step change in terms of trust and transparency, but let's look at each one separately. In the case of food, you're absolutely right. It is true that essentially the small farmer in Mombasa, he's not going to be running a blockchain node. That is not an issue, because the way we think about a blockchain solution is there will be participants who will be running nodes of the blockchain itself, and there'll be others who'll be consuming it almost like a software as a service solution. To them, it's just an application that they consume from a mobile wallet. Our approach here is basically try to make the barriers to entry as low as possible. But even then, there could be cases where, what if they don't even have a smartphone? I'm not trying to underplay the challenges, but we are fully aware of it, and we're trying to do as much as possible to lower the barriers. That's on the food safety side. Now, on the other problem, the one that you went after is fraud. Fraud happens because human beings are human beings. Technology is not going to solve it completely. But the way, again, I think about it is this is going to make it significantly more difficult for participants to do fraud once they start at the point at which they interact with the system. Because the system is going to have an immutable record of all transactions, non-repudiable, etc., etc. But if something happens off-chain, if you want to call it that, where basically there's some bribery or whatever that happens, that's outside of blockchain, and that's not a problem that we are intending to solve with the solution. But we're hoping that it makes it that much harder to do these things, though.
One of the interesting things about blockchain as being used by yourselves is it's very different to cryptocurrency, and it's probably a good opportunity at this point because you mentioned the challenge of people running their own nodes. If you could just give an example or explain what the difference is between the way cryptocurrency uses a blockchain mechanism and the permissive blockchain mechanism that IBM's using.
If you look at cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and what have you, there are two aspects to it. One is essentially the fact that they manage a shared ledger, and it has issues with respect to privacy and confidentiality, and that's why businesses don't typically use it. But to make that work, they had to come up with an incentive mechanism that led to the creation of cryptocurrencies. The world we are talking about is it's about businesses interacting with each other, And typically, there is no business interaction that happens without knowing who is the participant in a business interaction. In fact, governments want to know about it because almost every industry is regulated. We are living in a world where basically all the participants in a business transaction are known. Once they are known, what we're trying to achieve here, if you think about the inspiration from Bitcoin, all we're trying to do here is have a shared database, if you want to call it that, across the participants, such that they're sharing some information for doing the business they're doing, so that there's no need to have reconciliation, because people are not having their own copies of things. As in, you know, traditional database, I have my database, you have your database. It basically, collectively, you have a shared, yet distributed. There are many copies in a blockchain too, the nodes we talked about earlier. But these nodes are copies of the ledger that is in sync across the participants. That is basically the key difference, the fact that you have participants and you figure out a mechanism to stay, keep things in sync. And I'll say a little bit more about that in a second. And that makes it so much simpler in many ways than what happens with respect to things like how do you keep things in sync in the cryptocurrency world of Bitcoin. Here, if you think about it, all the participants are known. I only need to make sure that things are non-repudiable. If something goes in, you know for a fact that the person who did it cannot say, I didn't do it. Number two, what goes in, you do it with a vetting mechanism. Multiple parties now look at it and vet it. And not everybody has to vet it, by the way. You can immediately get the picture. It's more about making sure that enough people vet it so that you trust what went in is reliable. Number three, what goes into the blockchain or goes into the data layer, essentially you also want to make sure it's immutable. And the way it's done is there are multiple copies is one aspect of it. If there are 10 copies of something, I can't go in and change my copy because it becomes inconsistent with everything else. So that's one level of trust. And the other is this notion of chaining in a blockchain, right? These transactions are chained together so that if you tamper with something, say block 10 of billion blocks, all other blocks become inconsistent. You've got to do a lot of work to tamper with it. That's basically the main difference. Think of it as just a new type of database which can be trusted and used across participants. And an immediate consequence of that is you can run business processes, and people call it smart contracts, on a blockchain network. So all the examples I gave you of food safety, etc., etc., we really run smart contracts on a blockchain network across the participants. That's what we do.
The issue of scalability has become quite a topic lately. Again, if we look at the cryptocurrency side, that can scale to a point because of the number of nodes, but then can't scale beyond that because it's designed to have massive redundancy. The solutions that you're putting in place have the redundancy, they have the multiple nodes, but actually you're using far less nodes because of the way you're concentrating the data. What becomes your scalability limit, or is there no limit to the way it's being done now?
Excellent question. In terms of what we are doing with the Hyperledger Fabric version 1.0 that was just announced at this conference a couple of days ago, then I have to tell you the history of how we got there to it. I already mentioned IGF has been running in production since September last year. And we've been working with many banks for months, right, you know, many engagements. As part of that, what we realize is most businesses are not satisfied with the level of privacy and confidentiality that they get if there is identical copies at all nodes, even if the data in there is encrypted so that you ensure selective visibility. That's not good enough. Bank A and Bank B do something, they don't want that information in Bank C's node, even in an encrypted fashion. That led to that insight. We said, look, we got to rethink this whole consensus, which is at the heart of how blockchains work. We got to re-architect it from scratch in an innovative fashion where we split the consensus into three parts. Any transaction has some business logic. And that business logic, you separate it completely from the transactions are ordered to ensure that when you commit to the blockchain, you need to make sure exactly which happened first and the second. So there's an ordering service. And then finally, there is the piece that does validation. Maybe one transaction makes the next transaction inconsistent. You got to throw it out. We separated what happens in typical consensus in blockchains into three parts. And immediately you get tremendous benefits. Number one, the first piece of running the business logic, it only has to be run by the entities that are relevant. So if you and I do something, we both run that code corresponding to it. So it only runs in our nodes, if you want to call it that. Rest of them are not involved. It makes it immensely scalable. In fact, it's horizontally scalable tremendously, right? I could have support now billions of transactions in principle because as long as they're all happening in parallel, they happen in their own pockets, if you want to call it that. The ordering service is shared across everybody, but that basically, essentially, you know, it's a very simple ordering service. There's not a whole lot you need to do, and you can use any of the standard algorithms that are out there, you know, that you might have heard of for consensus like Raft, PBFT, what have you. Because of these two reasons, you know, there is scalability and confidentiality, because the business logic is run only by parties who need to do it. Number two, the data itself, only data of transactions that I'm involved in the network are on my node. That's the other big innovation here as part of the new architecture. So what this means is essentially things can be immensely scalable in the new setup. Thousands of transactions is not at all a big deal, which is a far cry from the rates we see in blockchain associated with cryptographic currency and all that. It's an apples to orange comparisons. I don't want to make that a big deal, but the point I'm making is now we can run at a scale that businesses care about, and a lot of applications are within the envelope of what we can do today. Sure, today I wouldn't do stock trading in the United States on a blockchain because that's a completely different scale. But based on what I just told you, the architecture is such that I wouldn't be surprised if in a couple of years, 2 or 3 years, we get there too.
I think that's quite important for people to understand, because if I look around, the answer to every problem at the moment seems to be somebody standing up and shouting blockchain. And clearly there are limits, and I think that's become a bit lost in a lot of the marketing and the noise around blockchain.
I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, this is why I use the term blockchain tourism. I think most of the use cases we have involved in, we've been very careful to ensure that we are using our time wisely. But there are many instances where, you know, I look at it and say, oh my God, you know, a standard database will do just fine, number one. Number two, you don't need any of the crypto-related stuff because the trust problem is not there. So why do you need a blockchain? That being said, I think there are plenty of examples and opportunities where there is a trust problem where blockchain could play a role. It plays a role only to the extent that technologies can play a role. Then, as I mentioned earlier, people are people. So you've got to sort of keep that in mind too.
One of the challenges with any form of encryption or encrypted system is we move so fast with technology that very quickly we come to that point where it is potentially possible to break it. IBM's just dropped 5-qubit, potentially even as much as 20-qubit quantum computing solutions available to people. We know that at 50 qubits we exceed anything we can do today. How much slack do we currently have in the way that blockchain is secured in the encryption before we start to have to rethink how we do some of that work because of what quantum changes?
I'm watching that space very closely, since I know that also we are doing in parallel. So it's an excellent question, and if 50-qubit quantum computing happens tomorrow, then all of the public cryptography techniques will that be called into question? Will they be valid? I don't know the answer to that question. The way I would think about it is quantum will take some time to get to something like 50 qubits. In fact, talking to the people who are working in IBM research on a regular basis, we have enough room to do a lot of exciting, useful things with blockchain before we run into that problem.
2020 was the date being given recently by IBM teams.
But I think it's not just enough to get to 50 qubits. You've got to also basically show that you can break some of these public key cryptography schemes too, right? So there's two steps to where I need to seriously worry about blockchain. At that point, it calls into question how we can trust anything on the internet. Blockchain is not what I worry about. Blockchain is, it's big, but still it's small in the scheme of things compared to everything that's going on the internet. There are bigger problems I would worry about before this happens.
If I can come back to some of the use cases, because there are some very interesting use cases out there. The first one I'd like to come back to is the Mahindra use case. They're not only using blockchain for their supply chain, but they've also brought in their own finance house. And that's to be able to pay people earlier in the system, because blockchain is giving them a trust point, rather than put a small supplier in the position where they wait 2 months for everything to work through. IBM has been saying something similar about its own supply chain since this time last year, and at Edge we started to see something about the numbers coming out. How much do you think that changes the whole supply chain mechanism, and what does that mean for small businesses? Are we going to finally get rid of this 120, 200 day payment terms that's killing the whole of the small business sector?
I think the last part, I do believe that that's going to change, but it'll take some time. Let's look at the IBM Global Financing use case right, concretely. We started working on that sometime in January of 2016. We sort of mentioned it in the February, March timeframe, as you rightly pointed out. And we rolled it out in September, just the day after Labor Day in the US, as a production deployment based on the previous version of Hyperledger. And given that we knew we were working on version 1, we decided to scale it up to a certain point, so in terms of the number of suppliers and partners, who are basically participants in that solution. And it's been running for quite some time now. The blockchain has more than 500,000 blocks in there, significant number of transactions. Just to make sure everybody understands what that use case is, we're talking about suppliers or sellers, you have buyers, and you have a financier that's IBM. And it's like what happens with consumers and credit cards. The buyer buys something from the supplier, and the supplier checks with IBM, hey, is the buyer good for the money? And IBM says yes, pays the money to the supplier, and a month or so later, the buyer pays IBM. In this model, essentially one of the biggest problems we had was disputes. So essentially what happens is, and it's very simple, you know, at the buyer's company, somebody receives the goods, and then a month later we're asking for the money, and say, oh, we didn't even receive the goods. It probably was misplaced, something like that. Very simple. What we decided to do was the entire end-to-end process of when the buyer goes to the seller and says, I want to buy something, to the approval from IBM, that workflow all the way from order placed till goods are received and payment is made, end-to-end process is captured on a blockchain as a smart contract across these three parties. So what does it do? We've been running it for 6 months. I can tell you that we have found amazing things. Number one, 40% of all of the disputes that we normally had are just simply gone. It's a very simple use case. We try to make sure that workflow with the salient information, proof of delivery. So when the logistics company, when they deliver the goods, it's on the blockchain. Everybody has a single version of the truth. So there's no reason for them to come back and tell us, IBM, hey, we haven't received the goods, because it's right there, the evidence is there. That's number one. Number two, there are still sometimes things that happen outside of the system. So for example, it could still be a dispute. It was not delivered, but there was something faulty in there, quality of the goods delivered. So we do still get some disputes, but now that most information around the logistics is already in there, the time it takes to resolve the residual disputes also has come down. So effectively, we feel like almost 65 to 70% of the disputes are gone. Now, it's not so much the disputes are gone that matters, but it's a business value. Why is it valuable? When there is a dispute, they have not paid us, that much money I can't lend to somebody else. It's capital efficiency. We had mentioned of the order of $100 million worth was tied up. Now imagine if 60 to 70% of them are released, that's a big deal. And not only that, from the point of view of the other participants, it's a significant benefit because, you know, disputes typically used to take 40 odd days to resolve. And now it could be much less, it could be a day, it could be no dispute at all. And so that's a significant customer experience improvement for all parties concerned.
If we look at another use case, we had the secure key announcement 2 days ago. Now, instead of there being a third party with whom we put everything and we work through the blockchain and then they put copies around, the idea is actually it will be my existing relationships with these people that is protected by blockchain. And then when I want to do a new relationship, instead of actually telling them to contact company A or company B, I simply have a new process built on top of blockchain that just says, yes, that person is who they say they are, without saying who has said it, just that there is a trusted party who has a blockchain relationship with the individual. That really adds to privacy, but it comes then back to the issue of scaling. Because if we do that in a business sense, when we talk about supply chain, we're talking about a limited number of entities in the market. When we talk about individuals, we start to talk about millions of entities in this market. How quickly do you think that type of system can grow? And what happens when it needs to interact with others? So for example, I'm working in this system, but I need to interact with a different blockchain system over there. How do we pass that data between the two?
Interoperability between blockchain networks or solutions is clearly something on our radar screen. We've been thinking about it for some time, and that will be solved. It has to be solved. Just to make it very concrete, imagine you mentioned Mahindra's earlier. You have the flow of goods, and let's say there is a logistics blockchain network. You have the flow of money that is related to the goods, so trade finance. There could be a banking network, blockchain network around that. Both of these things have to come together. Why? Because the bank, in some sense, will be happy to pay out when they know the goods have been delivered, for example. Interoperability, absolutely needed, will happen. Then going back to this question of identity and scale that you talked about earlier, I am super excited by the fact that, you know, here is an opportunity of using blockchain in a very intelligent fashion. You can put all of identity on a blockchain, but that is not what we are talking about here. We are talking about identity reside wherever they are, but the exchange of information is mediated on a blockchain. Now, this is very powerful because it's not just identities. It's much more in our view, and I'll come back to scale. Think about healthcare in the United States. I care about my healthcare data and where it resides. Right now, it's fragmented across a whole bunch of healthcare institutions, hospitals, radiologists, this, that, and the other place. I want to be in the loop if any information about me is shared back and forth. How do you make that happen? Do you make that happen by putting it all into this gigantic vault? Some people have tried to do that. I don't think it's feasible, and it has never succeeded. So I think this opportunity to basically have your individual's information footprint, regardless of healthcare, education, things related to banking, financial services, whatever, being spread all over the place, and yet with some trusted parties, because you need to, if it's your home address, hopefully you want to rely on the government, public records is the best place to rely on. And then the mediation of it done through a blockchain makes a lot of sense. Now, in that, you were talking about the number of transactions, the way I will look at it. If the number of transactions are small, regardless of the number of participants, there is no problem with the technology to handle it. Scale is not something that I worry about. In fact, what I worry about is more from the point of view of how quickly will there be adoption, and also what is the incentive mechanisms, right? And how do people basically, there should be an economic incentive. So effectively, you need micropayments of sorts. When I verify, let's say, somebody else's identity for a third-party service, how do I get paid? Because I'm doing something. Business side of things is what I think about more. Things will play out over time. You know, it looks very promising. Exactly how it'll play out, I don't know. But technology is not what I worry about.
We've seen finance, we've seen supply chain, we're seeing the two come together. What will be the next big unlock for blockchain?
I already alluded to a little bit. Identity, we touched upon. That whole thing about in the public sector space, everything to do with identity, you think of government disbursements, especially in developing countries, financial inclusion. I think there is a whole set of activities around individual identities as well as, you know, identities of companies. I expect, you know, blockchain to play a huge role in. The other area also I briefly touched upon, healthcare. I gave the consent management as an example. But in healthcare itself, I can think of at least four big clusters of use cases, just to give you a feel for it. Number one, consent management. You know, just knowing, getting control to patients in terms of their own healthcare data. Clinical trials. A lot of what happens in clinical trials, which happens over a long period of time, is pharmaceutical companies, in some cases, start out with a certain set of goals for a testing of a new drug they've come up with. Somewhere halfway through the process, they change the rules of the game because they've learned something about the drug. And by the time it comes out at the end, it's approved for something else. That seems a bit odd. You want to test for something, you want to do the test end-to-end. So in some sense, you can capture some of these clinical trials end-to-end process on a blockchain. Long-running process you want to trust, blockchain is perfect for. A third area is, which I touched upon from a supply chain perspective, which is provenance of medical goods, you know, devices, and also of pharmaceuticals is a third area.
Probably the biggest electronic medical records company out there is HIMS, HIMMS. They at the moment don't see blockchain as part of a permissive mechanism within what they talk for EMR. Are you engaging with them, or where do you start to engage with electronic medical record, patient record systems and the providers in the market?
Now, I'm not privileged to talk about who we are engaging with at this point in that space. Absolutely agree with you. Again, the thing to think about it is, you know, what is the entry point in this space? Because there is legacy existing medical records all over the place, right? And then some, you know, have consolidated. So the question is, how best to get into this space? And I think consent management might be the easiest way to get in, because you're mediating the exchange of information. And then over time, you could do more than that, perhaps. That seems like a right starting point, because given this is early days of the technology, any which way you look at it, despite the fact that I think there are a lot of blockchain is here and now is what I keep saying, and I know of examples where things are going in production, so I'm very proud of that. But at the same time, database technology has been around for decades, right? So I think that similarly, I expect blockchain also to evolve through time. Going after these pockets where you can see clear initial value, creating blockchain networks around the participants and doing all sorts of value-added services on top of them seems like the path to take, rather than go after the holy grail problems on day one.
Ramesh, thank you for your time today.
Thank you.